This interview with Ringu Tulku took place on October 10, 2019, in Boulder, Colorado. It contains 10 segments. He begins by describing the most important point about the Buddha Nature teachings for beginner Western students, defines Buddha Nature, and then delves into various topics. These include a discussion about the nature of mind and its relationship to Buddha Nature, the various texts that teach about Buddha Nature, the meaning of chapter 1, verse 25 of the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, and the relationship between sentient beings and the Buddha.
Important thing about the Buddha nature, especially for very beginners, is I think to have some kind of feeling that there is a basic goodness, you know, it's not kind of originally bad or original sin or something like that, but basic goodness. And this is something which I think is very important, especially like, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, there are lots of mind training kind of teachings coming from Kadampa tradition, Adishtipankara, and things like that. But the Gampopa wrote this book, Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which made a very, very different approach, where unlike any other this kind of mind training texts started with Buddha nature, you know, like the basis is the Buddha nature, and from there, so that became a very very special kind of way of approach. For those people who are kind of following those traditions where the Buddha nature is taught right from the beginning and as a very basic thing. And so in the West, that I think makes a lot of sense. And even the Gelugpa masters like Lama Yeshe taught, you know, Jewel Ornament of Liberation a lot, and even Taiyab Shangyur Rinpoche, you know, Taiyab Shangyur Rinpoche in Germany, Tibet House in Frankfurt. He actually invited me a few times to his centers to teach that part of Jewel Ornament of Liberation. That's the main thing, I think, that it starts to, people start to understand and feel or, you know, look from the point of view of basic goodness. I think when you talk about the Buddha nature, basically, I think you have to understand that the way we are, the way everybody is not really different from what a fully enlightened being is. Or in another word, you know, completely pure being and completely impure being is basically the same. Only difference is that one recognizes what he is or who he is, and another doesn't recognize what he is or who he is, and that's the difference. Then if you look at, you know, like especially from the Buddhist point of view, the first and most, if you go back to the beginning, the question Buddha asked was, you know, is there an possibility to become free from all kind of problems and sufferings and pain? And then he saw that, you know, there are so many the difficulties and problems and sufferings that, you know, you cannot really completely get rid of, you know. He was supposed to, you know, he was predicted to be able to become one of the most, you know, greatest emperor. But he saw that even if he became the greatest emperor, the most powerful one, there are lots of things he could not do, or there nothing could be done about. So therefore, then he thought, what can we do? Is there no hope for the human beings to free ourselves from our problems and sufferings, or is there another approach? That's why he went away to search another way, and that's how he, what we call his enlightenment, is to find that that solution. And that solution was that that we cannot completely get rid of all the things that is not good, or that can be problematic, or that would cause problems for us. If we can make something get rid of, and then it'll come again, and you know, all these kind of things. Only way that we can do something is that we can transform ourselves, we can change our own way of experiencing things. And if I can change my way of experiencing myself, then that would change my way of experiencing, you know, and therefore I could free myself from all the problems. And that's what we call the, you know, salvation or freedom or nirvana or whatever you call it. And there, the reason why is that there's a possibility, you know, that possibility to transform. Is that possibility only for some people, or is that possibility for everybody? So when we talk about Buddha nature, then is to indicate that possibility is for everybody. It's not reserved for some people or, you know, some kinds of species or anything like that, but that is for everybody. So that's, I think, the basic concept of Buddha nature. And I think in Buddhism, although the word Buddha nature or Tathagata Garbha was not mentioned in the first teachings of Buddha, but it's kind of there in a unexpressed way, unspecific way, you know, like in many different levels of teachings of Buddha, you know. Sometimes people think they are very different from each other. And this, when Buddha was talking about the Shravakayana teachings, then he was not talking about the, you know, emptiness and, you know, like Madhyamaka teachings. And then when he was teaching about that, he was not talking about Vajrayana teachings and things like that, but it's kind of there, you know. Like for instance, when he was teaching only Vinaya teachings, where there was no mention about, you know, the Mahayana concepts too much, but he always mentioned Bodhisattva, Buddha was Bodhisattva before he became Buddha. And all sutras say the same thing. You know, he was a Bodhisattva. All the Jataka stories tell about Bodhisattva did this, Bodhisattva did that. It's just that they didn't explicitly elaborate what a Bodhisattva was and whether somebody could become a Bodhisattva and how he or she would become a Bodhisattva and what's the training of the Bodhisattva. And my other teachings or second and third round of what we call the Buddha's Dharmachakra teachings are all about that. You know, what is a Bodhisattva and how to train to be a Bodhisattva. And then when he was giving teachings on the Shunyata and, you know, all this kind of Pragyaparamita teachings, there are lots of mention about Buddha nature. But again, it is not so explained, so much, you know, clearly exposed about what Buddha nature was. But then when the third round of teachings and then Vajrayana is all about that, you know, the explanation of Buddha nature on top of the things that he mentioned before. So I think it is like that. Now, you know, when we first talk about Buddha nature, it is like, as I said, that everybody has the capacity or can become enlightened or can free themselves from suffering. That's the why? Because that's their nature, you know. I don't think it's you know, it's not that, you know, there is something called Buddha nature. You know, this, I think, there's some kind of scholarly, you know, discussions about these things. I think it's a little bit going in a wrong way. There's nothing, something called Buddha nature there. It's just the describing the way we are. You know, that's you know, the way we are or where our, you know, what we are is basically, you can say our body and mind, you can say, if you like to make it, or in another way, you know, from the little bit, maybe from Vajrayana point of view, they talk about, you know, six elements. We are six elements. And six elements means like earth element, water element, fire element, wind element, space element, and consciousness element, you know. So that's what every being is, for instance. Now, what is this conscious element, you know? You can call it conscious element, you can call it mind, if you like. But, you know, so this, what is it? You know, that's the whole point. You know, what is, how does it exist? How does it exist? So that then, you know, it has, it's to describe it, to explain, it has, it is an awareness. So that awareness is sometimes called clarity. You know, clarity, or sometimes people use the English word luminosity, salva, vesal, you know. That is not a light or, you know, something. That is kind of making making some kind of a shining thing, but you know, our mind has the capacity to know, you know, as that That is, I think, the clarity. But then that clarity, if you try to find out where is it and what it is made of, or, you know, is there anything that you can, you know, put it into some kind of a test tube and analyze, there is nothing. You can't, it doesn't have a substance, it doesn't have a shape, it doesn't have a form, it doesn't have a, you know, it is beyond any of those elements. So therefore, it's called emptiness, no? So this, you know, awareness or clarity and emptiness is the, you know, the way that is, that consciousness is. And because it is a clarity, it is it has the awareness, it has the conscious part, therefore anything can, you know, anything can manifest. There can be thoughts, there can be emotions, there can be sensations, there can be perceptions, there can be... So then all experiences we have are kind of manifestations of that basic clarity. So these three are not separable, you know, it's the same thing. And that's from Vajrayana point of view, they call it, or not even the Vajrayana point of view, from the Mahayana point of view also, we call it four kayas, three kayas, and whatever, and that's what Buddha is, you know. But that is not only Buddha, that is also the same as every consciousness. The nature of all the consciousness is that. So that's why it's called Buddha nature, you know. But we don't recognize it like that. We recognize that all these manifestations that we have is something that is happening to us from outside, and so therefore we react with something, you know, with what we call with duality. This is something nice, I like it. This is something not nice, I don't like it. And therefore, all kind of negative emotions and, you know, all these problems and, you know, samsaric situation. So samsaric experience also comes from the same thing. And the enlightened experience also comes from the same thing. And the only difference is that if you recognize this nature, then the samsaric experience can transform into freedom from samsaric. Otherwise, we have the, so that's, I think, you know. So it's not that Buddha nature is somewhere there inside us. Mm-hmm. It's just our own mind itself. Mm-hmm. How its true nature is. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, Buddha nature. And I think that's why, you know, the Tathagata Garbha, when they translated into Tibetan as Deshi Jingpo, you know, I think they did a very good translation by meaning Jingpo, you know, because if you translate as like Garbha as womb, or then it wouldn't fit into the actual understanding of it. I think the main reason main reason why Buddha also didn't teach it right from the beginning, and main reason why they don't teach about Buddha nature right from the beginning too much, is I think in India, was maybe because you might misunderstand it as Atma, you know. because although it's nothing to do with Atma, but you know, Buddhist teachings was very much based on impermanence and anatma, and Hindu teachings were very much based on Atma. So, you know, if you say Buddha nature, and then if you get, if you didn't understand emptiness and all these things a little bit, then it could be possible that you take it as something like an Atma. I think main reason why it was not talked too much about could be that, could be that. And also because it was mainly taught in the third turning and then in Vajrayana. But Vajrayana you cannot do without. But of course there are also different ways, different styles of, like in Gelug tradition, it's more, you know, they don't too much emphasize on Buddha nature, they emphasize more on emptiness, even in Vajrayana. From the kind of, those kind of what we call, say, treatises from, usually, you know, when we talk about like Nagarjuna, then we talk about like Dechuk, you know, Dechuk, and then Rikchuk, and no, Tamchuk, Rikchuk, and Dechuk, you know. What is called as Tam means like letters, you know. That kind of group of instructions, or you know, like Tam is more or less like discussion, discussion. But actually, mainly his letters, especially to the king, and things like that, which are understood to be more on the like general teachings of. Then Rikchok, which is more Uma teachings, you know, like Madhyamika teachings, like Madhyamika Mula Shastra and all these kind of things. The five or six, sometimes we can six, sometimes we call it five. And then Dechuk is group of teachings on praising, you know, Dopa means praising. So these are about Buddha nature, actually. More about Buddha nature, more about the third. Third Dharma Chakra teachings. So from Nagarjuna's, it's like that. And those are also studied, I think, quite a lot. And then from the, you know, because in Tibet, the most important two traditions, you know, one that coming from the Nagarjuna and one coming from the Asanga. And from the Nagarjuna side, this is how it is. And from the Asanga side, then mainly it's the Uttaratantra Shastra. Then there are, of course, lots of other sutras, you know, all the sutras belonging to the third Dharma Chakra are all talking about Buddha nature, and very, very strongly about Buddha nature. And then later in Tibet, I think, probably, I don't know exactly, but probably Gampo Pass, you know, jewel ornament of liberation, and his teachings, he has many, are basically the first kind of basic teachings, and you know, most kind of common teachings on Buddha nature, probably. And then, of course, then later on, you know, all these Dharanathas and all kind of Jonang teachings, and you know, every school of Buddhism in Tibet had a kind of some very much emphasizing the Madhyamika only, and or Madhyamika, everyone Madhyamika, but especially a little bit more like towards the Buddha nature side, and another more towards the emptiness side and things like that. Mm. In Sakya also, Sakya Chogden was very much on Buddha nature and very much. And then Longchenpa, most of his teachings, you know, all his seven treasures and everything, there's lots of Buddha nature, there's very much based on those things. So, you know, and then later on, Mipam Rinpoche wrote things, and I think it's like that. I think the first text I studied to do it was, I think, Deshi Nyingpo Tongtun Singha Ngaro, you know, that's the Mipham Rinpoche's text. Probably that was the one.
First time.
I didn't, before that, I didn't think I studied other texts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is not supposed to be like that, you know. At that time when I was a student, I didn't study in the Sheda way, you know, with a group of students from, I studied alone with Kempos. And that time it was very difficult to get texts. So we didn't study because, you know, this is better to first and then next and then next. We just studied whatever text that was available. So that's how, you know, Deshi Nyingpo Tongtun Singha Ngaro was, I think, first thing that I studied on this kind of. It's possible that somebody was asking the Kempo, my Kempo, you know, Kempo Lama Rinchen. Somebody asked him to teach that, and then he was teaching that, and I joined in. I think something like that, but that's nothing kind of. It's not. That's the usual way. You know? Mm-hmm. Usual way is not usually like that. Generally, Jamgon controls, you know, he holds this Rime. His Rime in approach very much. And he holds, you know, he tries to understand all as very correct and very true and very, you know, and this is this approach, I think, is very important because, you know, like generally, I think, you know, the Tibetan approach, I don't know whether I should say Tibetan. Maybe it's Nalanda approach, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But there's always like Gaya Pangsung, you know. When you study something, you do Gaya Pangsung. You know how it is, to kind of negate the other's views. Then you posit your own views. Then you, you know, kind of debate and get answer all the questions and get rid of all the doubts from your view. And so these three approaches. And almost all commentaries from all schools are kind of a little bit based on this approach, you know. And this approach is very good in one way, because you kind of you make you go very subtle, you go very deep about everybody, how it is, and then, you know, and present your views also very deeply and very clearly and very kind of elaborately, sometimes very subtle, and then, you know, you kind of differentiate it from every other views, and, you know, then answer all the questions, and, you know, this is how. But sometimes I feel that this makes people a little bit more dogmatic. Yeah, mm-hmm. This is my view, and I have to defend my view, and I have to reject all other views. I found this. Maybe I don't know if I should say it in this kind of format. Once or twice I saw some kind of conferences that His Holiness Dalai Lama kind of called the great, you know, the campus from all different schools to try to bring in the, you know, the unity of all the Buddhists. And then there, sometimes I feel they're all kind of debating rather than unifying. Yeah, because they, you know, they were used to defend their own thing, and they're used to, you know, kind of, what can you say, argue with, and then it was very difficult because they have to go very subtle, and some of the differences are very subtle. You know, I don't really understand the differences too much. You know. In a deep way. Sometimes I feel that these differences are more about, you know, it's very small differences and very subtle differences, and, you know, like mainly about how you say it. You know, like if you say it like this, then it could be misunderstood like this, and then it could be like this, and and then the other one say, no, if you say like your way, it could be misunderstood like this. I mean, anything, any way you say could be misunderstood anyway, you know. So I get a little confused when these things too much, and, you know, I heard once that there was a debate between Mipha Rinpoche and one very learned Gelugpa master in front of, you know, Patu Rinpoche. And Patu Rinpoche was the judge. And then these two were debating. And then there were lots of, you know, very bright lamas and campus, and, you know, I think from Nyima and from other schools also. And they were saying, they later mentioned, that it's, I think, maybe also in the, some of the biographies, that in the morning they could understand what they were saying, but in the afternoon they didn't know what they were saying. So it's a little bit like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of goes sometimes so subtle that you kind of don't understand what is the the point.
Right.
So So Jamu Kontu says, you know, he says that, you know, like this Yentong and Rangtong, you know, it's basically, you know, one is about Buddha nature way of, another is from the kind of Pragyaparamita way of. Of course, both are Pragyaparamita anyway, but he says that, you know, for like Rangtong is to analyze something, you know, what is the nature of this, what is the nature of this. Like if you are looking at something, if you are like looking at the nature of things and then you analyze, that approach is Rangtong is the way, it's the best way. But Yentong is that you, if you try to talk about the experience, you know, how you experience and how you, then it's the Yentong way is better. That's how he says, and that's how he puts them together. I like that stand because, you know, all the things that is said in the kind of Buddha nature and Yentong and all this kind of approach way is mainly about from the experience of, you know, from how you experience things in the meditative state of experience things. And the when you analyze and then it's like this is emptiness and, you know, that is about, you know, you are looking at something and then, you know, analyzing it. So it's just two different ways of looking like that. And Jamu Kontul is, you know, he's like that. I mean, he's some people also, you know, Kontul also, some people explain in another way, and some people explain in another way, you know. So, you know, even Mipham Rinpoche has two different, you know, ways of explaining Mipham Rinpoche. we are all samsaric beings, and samsaric beings is always having problems and suffering, and all the, you know, all these kleshas and karma and negative emotions, so lots of problems. I think this the main approach is that, you know, what is a Buddha, for instance, in one way, you know. Buddha is somebody who has developed or awakened his or her wisdom and compassion to the utmost. That's a Buddha. Yeah. So now, do we have a little bit of seedling of that or not in us? And I think that's the first approach. You know? That however kind of negative or however bad or evil or, you know, however uncompassionate or unkind you are, every person has a little bit of some kind of a soft corner for somebody, some kind of kindness or compassion or, you know, soft corner, love. And that's the seed of, you know, compassion. And everybody has, however, you know, ignorant or however stupid they are, they have a slight, a little bit of understanding, knowing what is right, what is wrong, what is proper, what is not proper. Some understanding, and that's the seed of wisdom, yeah? And these two can improve, can develop. You know, it might take many lifetimes, but this can improve, and this is what we should do. This is the practice. You know, practice is to work and improve, and you know, try to develop our wisdom and compassion. And this is all the whole practice of Dhamma is about that, actually. And that's the, you know, that's the first. And when we're talking about even this, you know, like whether there is kind of a gotra, you know, or a rik, is all talking about that, you know, whether we have a little bit of some little essence or some little seed or some little of that wisdom and compassion or not, you know. I think one thing which is very important from Buddhist point of view is that wisdom thing, you know, which I think is not very much talked about in any other way of, you know, whether it's a modern education, psychology, whether it's a different philosophies and religions and things like that, you know, our consciousness, you know, they don't talk about wisdom part of it, no? Many times I heard, like in the kind of psychological, they say that, you know, it's the fear, you know, like if you cross a road and you need to have fear, because if you don't have fear, you don't know how not to be hit by the car. That's totally different from Buddhist point of approach. From Buddhist point of approach, it's not the fear, but the wisdom that prevents us from hit by the car when you cross the, because the fear doesn't do that. Fear actually becomes, makes you more nervous, and then panic, and then makes you actually hit by the car. So basic wisdom, you know, that is something I think very basic and very important, and to really understand that every being has that basic wisdom, yeah? And that basic wisdom, we can improve, we can develop, we can through education, through training, through, you know, through all different kind of practices and things like that. In the similar way, our, you know, our kindness, compassion, you know, through understanding, through. So that's, these are the, you know, basic, I think. Wisdom can be of, you know, any different levels, you know, to be able to function as a proper person in the society also needs wisdom, no? And to be able to do something successfully is also needs that. And then to become a good professional in any branch of profession also needs that. And then to become a good human being, a good leader, a good, you know, a good good person, good friend, good, you know, husband, wife, teacher, you know, that, then it can become more and more, and then you can also have wisdom of knowing the true nature of things, and you know, everything more, then you can become a Buddha also. But, you know, that's quite high one, you know. So there are different levels of wisdom and different levels of compassion and kindness also. Mm. Yeah. Basically, everybody likes to, this is another basic wisdom also, in a way, that I want to be, I don't want suffering, I don't want problem, I don't want pain, yeah?
and I want happiness, I want joy, I want to be free. Yeah. That's also a basic wisdom, no? But we don't know how to do that, you know. So we need to learn step by step. Like sometimes you think that if I'm very upset and I'm angry, I do bad things, I'm aggressive, and that would help. But then slowly you learn that that wouldn't help. Then, you know, you learn a little better how to communicate, how to make things in a more, you know, strong, clearly communication, and, you know, different ways, you know. So, you know, anything, you know, that would make it a little bit more first understand the causes and conditions of your own, you know, suffering and happiness. Then also, like, a little bit understand other people, and then how to train on that, how to work with your emotions, you know, how to become a little bit more calm and clear, and then, you know, how to meditate slowly, and then, you know, step by step. Yeah, this is about basically talking about, you know, why you say that, why it's understood that everybody has Buddha nature. You know, that's the reason, three reasons given. This the words are not easy. I think you could explain, or you can elaborate or comment slightly different way, many different ways, slightly different ways, and but. When you say Dzogchen Kun and Toshe To, you know, this Buddha's kind of kaya is radiating. Mm-hmm. Many masters from my tradition, at least, says it's referred to Dhammakaya. What is Dhammakaya? I think if you, you know, like, I think it's more or less same thing that we talked about a little bit, that if you look at the nature or your mind, probably it's not just Dhammakaya, but this three kayas, you know, like, it's like that. Although this way of that what I explained is not so much explained in the sutras, it's more explained in the tantras and Mahamudra. But I think that's what more or less it means, that, you know, if you look at the nature of your mind, it's like that. Whoever's mind it is, you know, it has the awareness, clarity, but it has no, it's emptiness, and it is, you know, you know, kind of unceasing manifestation, and that's same with every mind, every consciousness, and every, and the Buddha's mind is also the same, and my mind is also the same, so it radiates with that, you know, Buddha's awareness or explanation. There's nothing other than that. You can't find anything, another mind which is not like that. You know, you can't find any mind which is not like that, you know. So that's, you know, it radiates with the Buddha kayas. Kayas means all three kayas, not necessarily maybe Dhammakaya, you know. And then, you know, Tehin Yi Meshito means like if you look at anything, you know, its nature is emptiness. Emptiness and awareness, emptiness and appearance, everything. Everything is like that. You know. There's nothing, one thing different than another. You know, the way I am, the way Buddha is, the way the most kind of the lowest kind of form of being or anything, you know, the tree or fire or Buddha realm or hell realm or wherever you go, the way everything is same, you know. It's not, nothing is different. It's just it's appearance in emptiness, it's awareness in emptiness. So there's no, you know. So if it is like that, then, you know, in a way, in reality, there's nothing called kind of a samsara somewhere else and Buddha or enlightened state or nirvana somewhere else is all same. But, you know, person who have nirvana experience sees the same thing in a kind of a undiluted or what can you say, in a clear way. And a person in the samsarics sees that in a deluded way. And the main difference is not how things are, but how one perceives. So therefore, it's all, basically, it's, you know, there's no difference. Taking it, the how, taking it means the way it is. You know, the way it is not different. Yeah? And then Ryushir, that is this thing that we all have, people have that, a little bit of, you know, however small. There's some rick, some kind of, what can you say, some seed, some, like, rick gotra is like almost like a DNA. Yeah. Has some DNA. So therefore it can develop. So because of these three reasons, then its Buddha nature is there.
And what do you think about the final line about, do we possess, does a sentient being possess this Buddha heart, this Buddha essence? Or is a sentient being Buddha nature in a sense? Is a sentient being a Buddha? Or is a sentient being totally not a Buddha?
You know, it's like that. It's You know, you can't say sentient being is a Buddha, because sentient being or samsaric being is not Buddha. Because Buddha is, you call, there is nothing called Buddha on its own. Buddha is someone who sees things clearly. When he sees things clearly, then it's Buddha. When he doesn't see things clearly, he's called samsaric. Yeah? I think this, you know, sometimes people cannot, like sometimes people ask this kind of questions. Is impermanent permanent or impermanent?
Right. You know?
It's not a question. You
know? Yeah.
Because impermanence is not a thing. It's about, you know, it's description. You know, the things keep on changing. That's impermanence. There's nothing called impermanence.
Right.
Yeah? So you can't say impermanence, permanence, or impermanence, because if you call this is permanent, impermanent, that means like, you know, there is nothing called impermanence. You know, there's nothing called impermanence. It's just a description. Many times people don't understand this, and then they ask questions and make debate, and then you can't get anywhere because it's just, you know, it's very only in the, you know, in the. So there are lots of questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's. I think this is very important to understand this, and you know, because you can't say, you can't, you know, you can't say samsaric being is Buddha, because it's not Buddha. Yeah. He's Buddha when he understands things and sees things. And but, you know, the Buddha, there's nothing called Buddha. The aspect or the, you know, that situation when somebody is fully sees things clearly, and that situation is called Buddha, no? So you can't say the sentient being is samsara, also not, because samsara is, you know, when that the sentient being is very, you know, deluded, and then he's in that caught up in his own misunderstanding, then he's samsaric. But you know, like usually they say, like in the dual ornament of liberation, they say the difference between samsara and nirvana is a misunderstanding. You know, so the misunderstanding. What's a misunderstanding? You know, and there again, you know, they say, when did people become samsara? As if, you know, you became, first you were enlightened and then become unenlightened. It's not like that, because misunderstanding has no beginning. You know? Or like not knowing has no beginning. You know, say like I come today here and now I know this, you know, the Chandra Foundation is here. But since when I didn't know that this was the place where Chandra Foundation was. You know, you can't say, because, you know, it's not that I knew and then I forgot. I didn't know. So when I didn't know, I didn't know. You know, it's not no beginning. You know? But then when you know, then it's ended. So, you know, all ignorance is like that. There is no beginning. But there is an end. Because when you know it, then you know it.
Right.
You know?